If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed.
How did a severed ear start a war between Britain and Spain in the 18th century? And what has Queen Victoria's armpit got to do with the development of antiseptic? Speaking to Charlotte Hodgman, medical doctor and historian Dr. Susie Edge delves into some of the most intriguing and at times gruesome stories of the people whose body parts have made history. This episode contains graphic details that some listeners may find upsetting.
So probably the first question is, where did all this start?
I said it actually at the beginning of the book, that it really did start the day I picked up a scalpel and started doing dissection in anatomy classes. I was lucky enough to train in Aberdeen, which is a really old anatomy school. And it was just all, I could feel the stories coming through already. But I've spent years collecting stories of body parts. But yeah, the stories, they've come and they've really come together nicely recently, because I was writing my first book last year, which was about the deaths of the kings and queens of England and Scotland. And there were loads of stories beyond these shores and elsewhere, and lots of other characters that were coming up. And people send me stories on TikTok, because I have quite a vibrant TikTok following with all these stories come back to me. So I started collecting them all together and themes start to come through. It's wonderful to see these things develop.
Well, I mean, I was going to ask you kind of what comes first, the body part or the story?
When I went looking for some of the stories that I hadn't come across, my Google search history is hilarious. But I worked my way down from head to toe. And in some instances, I did go looking for body parts specifically. But in others, I just knew that there were some little, you know, little tidbits. Sometimes you hear a story about something else. You're reading about some other historical event. And these are throwaway comments. But to me, of course, because I'm looking for those human body history stories, they pop out to me and I go digging about further into them.
I mean, there's some great stories across the book. What was your favourite story, would you say, that you came across?
I was really blown away by the story of Alexis St. Martin. And I say blown away specifically because he was a fur trader from Michigan in the 1820s who was trading furs. He was standing at a trading post one day and he was accidentally shot at close range in the chest. And it made a mess. He did survive, but he was left with a hole into his stomach, this patent hole for the rest of his life. And the surgeon spent years experimenting on him.
So you could actually see into his stomach?
Could actually see in. And it needed to be well wrapped up because food, and he liked a whiskey, would just pour out of it when he had some. So yeah, the surgeon experimented on him, would stick bits of food on string into the hole and pull it out to see about the digestion process. And we learnt a lot about the physiology of digestion from that, because you couldn't see into the stomach before. And at one point, he even stuck his tongue in it to see what it would taste like. Which, I mean, I think when I tell that story, the response I get is remarkable. But it's so much more to in that. It's all about the story of power that the doctor had over the guy and consent and all this stuff.
Through these stories, what else have you kind of learned about the history of this type of thing?
Well, really, it is just one huge theme of what we allow and consent and who gets to decide what happens to people. The story of Charles Byrne and his bones is a fascinating one as well. This was a chap from Ireland who was born in the 1700s, who was a giant. He had a pituitary tumour, which made him grow and grow. He didn't stop growing. And he used that. He would go around showing it off. He earned money from doing so. And he caught the attention of the surgeons, Hunter in particular, who wanted his body to study when he died. And he told his friends, he explicitly told his friends he did not want that to happen. He wanted to be buried at sea. And yet it didn't happen because the powerful, rich surgeons got in there, they got hold of his body. And he spent, you know, the best part of 200 years on display in a museum. Until recently, the Hunterian decided to honour his request and not put him back on display when they reopened at the Royal College of Surgeons of England.
Some of the body parts that you cover do still exist. Einstein's brain. What's this weird fascination we have, do you think, of keeping these body parts? Napoleon is another one.
Yeah, and some that are kept that pretend to be what they say they are, like Rasputin's member, which doesn't appear to be that because it's a sea cucumber, I think. But it's put on display and people go and see it thinking that's what they're going to see. We have this weird way, don't we, of saying that rest in peace and we expect that when we're buried that we're going to be left alone. And yet, over the years, the Georgians and the Victorians in particular just love to dig up a body and take parts and keep parts. We love them. Galileo's middle finger is sitting on display in a museum. People flock to see it. And I do too. I do as well. As a medic, as somebody who is trained in surgery, who gets to open up bodies on the daily and have a look inside, I find it all absolutely fascinating. But of course, a lot of people don't do that every day and they don't get to see what's inside. And there are, you know, the displays of the body parts by Gunther von Hagens, for instance, the Body Worlds exhibitions. Millions of people have been to see those. And perhaps it's because every day we don't normally get to look inside a knee, for instance, and see the shiny knee replacement or inside a heart. We don't normally get to do that.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
I suppose with historical figures, it's the closest we can get to knowing them, I guess, isn't it? That kind of physical part of them.
Yeah. There was a certain amount of me feeling a lot closer when I was writing these stories, that often when I'm reading, I don't know about other people, often when I'm reading about historical figures, it's what they did and what happened and the dates and everything else. It's almost abstract in a way. But when you suddenly, when you're looking at the idea of somebody's body part, it becomes more real to me.
Just like us, yeah. There's lots of humour and lots of kind of funny stories in, but there's also some quite sad stories in the book. One that kind of stood out for me was Fanny Burney. Can you tell us a little bit about her?
It is a sad story, but she survived, and she survived to write down, she wrote in letters to her sister what happened to her. She was an early 19th century novelist, actually, who felt a lump in her breast one day. And it really got to the point where she needed attention, and the surgeons decided that they would go in and take this lump out. And this was a time pre-anaesthetic, pre-antiseptic. She saw the glint of the surgeon's knife as it came down towards her, and then she described the rubbing of the knife on her chest and on her ribs as they cut through her breasts and took it away. It's a really harrowing letter to read. She wrote it 9 months later when she was recovering, and she was still recovering at that point. But she did okay. There was no infection and she survived. But what really struck me was what else happened after that, that there were a lot of surgeons at that point who were trying to replace breast tissue that they were taking out of women, and they put all sorts of things in there to try and recreate the size and shape and, oh yeah, stones and marbles and cotton.
Did you go and see any of these body parts that still exist? Did you go and see any of those in person?
I tried to go and see, you know, I mentioned Charles Byrne earlier. I tried to go and see his bones, which was an awkward situation because I knew that I was writing about the fact that he didn't want that to happen. And yet I found myself heading towards the museum to go and see it. So, yeah, I had a word with myself about that. And I would have liked to have gone to Iceland, where there is a phallological museum there. But I didn't get to see Napoleon's member because that lives in a box in a house in New Jersey. I didn't get to travel over there. So the answer is no, I didn't get to see a lot of these things, but I plan to.
Yeah. What about Einstein's brain? Whereabouts is that? Because that's always fascinated me.
There are bits of Einstein's brain at the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia, which is a medical history museum in Philadelphia. And here, he's got a bit there.
Just staying with Einstein's brain, after he died and sort of experiments and stuff were done on it, what were people looking to find, and what did they find anything different about his brain?
This was another case of the original owner not wanting to share the brain, but it was just taken because he was dead, and the pathologist who got the job of dissecting him took his eyes and gave them to an ophthalmologist and took his brain out and kept it in a cookie jar for years. Yeah, so it was looked at wholly, if you like, to see if there was any difference in the gross anatomy. And there wasn't much going on there. It was all just looked the same as yours and mine. The thing I find about the brain is how, you know, you can look at any structure of the body, really, and see its form and figure out from that its function. But the brain, you just can't. You just can't look. You can't slice open a brain and say, this is what happens.
No, no.
From this part of the body, which I absolutely love. But his brain was dissected into lots of different pieces, looked at under a microscope. It was thought that there was some overgrowth in the corpus callosum, the bit that attaches the two sides of the brain, if you like, that there was more of that than anywhere else. That would suggest more communication going on. But was that something that he was born with, or was that something that developed because he was thinking all the time about these things? So we can't tell, we don't know. But I think that there was a lot of disappointment when it came to trying to figure out if there was anything in his brain that could tell us why he was so smart and how he was able to think the way he could. There was disappointment there because we wanted to show that he had this physical thing that we didn't have, and that would have been an explanation. We would have gone, oh, okay, fair enough. Well, he had that and we don't, so good on him, but we're not going to be that smart.
Did you sort of find out about kind of any tests that were done on any of these body parts to prove that they belong to certain people?
Yeah, I'm really tempted again to go back to Napoleon and Rasputin. So the penises of Napoleon and Rasputin are supposedly still around and on display. And the one of Rasputin is enormous and nobody really believes that it's his. It was tested a wee while ago and it's now thought to be a sea cucumber that's sitting in a jar that people are going to go and see. And Napoleon as well, well, that was tested to see if it was actually a penis because it looked really kind of shriveled and not very like how you'd imagine. And it was actually bought by a urologist. And if anyone knows anything about that sort of thing, it would be a urologist. So he studied it and decided that it was in fact a penis, but there's no way of identifying that that was belonging to Napoleon. So it's just accepted that that's what it is.
In the book also, which I find really fascinating, is how some of these body parts that you're looking at have bigger impacts on history. I think it was Queen Victoria's armpit is one. Can you give us some examples of that?
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about Queen Victoria's armpit. What a great place to dig around in. Why not? So she was up in Scotland at her castle at Balmoral, and she was feeling something in her armpit, something sore. And as you do, she prodded it and poked it and wouldn't leave it alone. And it grew and grew into an abscess. And it grew into an abscess the size of an orange, to the point where she couldn't really move her arm very well. And a surgeon was called in, and that surgeon happened to be Lister, who was in Edinburgh, who was developing his antiseptic techniques. And he came up on his carriage carrying his antiseptic, and he sprayed it around the room, sprayed it in her face. She wasn't very happy about that. She was not amused. And he cut open this armpit, and he drained out all the pus, and he fixed her up, and she survived. Now, Queen Victoria also used anaesthetic as well early on. She used it when she had one of her children, Leopold, I think. And so she was championing these ideas, these new technologies. And to have the monarch on side when you're trying to show the world something is a pretty good coup. So she was helpful in that, because if it's good for the Queen, it's good for the rest of us.
And the War of Jenkins' Ear is another interesting one.
Yeah, so in the 1700s, the British wanted more trade in the Caribbean. They weren't getting it. They had a deal with the Spanish that they could take and trade a certain amount of goods over there. They exchanged slaves that they'd brought from Africa, because the Spanish weren't very good at doing that, but they still needed or still wanted to use the slaves, so they would get them from the British. But part of this big deal was that the British only had a certain amount of trade, but they were filling up their boats with other things, contraband, black market stuff. Goods. And the Spanish were allowed to board the ships and have a look when they were leaving and see if there was anything that shouldn't be there. And one day, a ship called Rebecca left Jamaica for England. The captain was a chap called Jenkins. And his ship was boarded by the Spanish. They couldn't find anything but sugar They were a bit annoyed because they were looking for other things. He said, I don't have anything. I don't have anything else. And he was held down and his ear was cut off. With the comment that the king even tried to do this, we'd cut his ear off as well. And Jenkins was a bit annoyed and he took his ear back in a jar back to England and he showed Parliament. Parliament weren't really that excited at the time. But later on, when they decided they wanted more trade and they wanted to go after the Spanish, they got him out again with his ear in a jar and paraded him around and said, look at this. This is what the Spanish have been doing to us. And it was used then as the trigger to go to war with Spain. And later on, Carlyle named it the War for Jenkins' Ear, which I think is fantastic.
Yeah, definitely. Are there any other stories that you'd kind of want to share?
I think that one that I love to think about that I really feel I can't do any justice to is the story of Henrietta Lacks and her cells, her cervical cells. In the 1950s, she was a black American who had cervical cancer and died of it, but not before her biopsies were taken, sent off to a lab. And it was found that these cells were incredible because of the genetic abnormalities that had led to the cancer. These cells were growing and they were growing in perpetuity. And before that point, there was a need to find cells that would not just die off in the lab. Everything that was trying to be done in the labs in this new era of molecular biology and cell biology, everything was just dying. But these cells lived on and on and on. And they were taken and they were sent off around the world. So you could pay a fee and get some of these cells and do your work on them. So they were studied not just to find out how cells worked, but they were also used to create pharmaceuticals and all sorts of medications. And so these cells were called HeLa cells, H-E-L-A, after Henrietta Lacks. I wrote about them, used them when I was studying molecular biology back in the 90s, but I had no idea where these had come from and nobody did. And the story is coming out now that these were taken without consent. Without consent of her family, and were used to create everything that we've done in cell biology for the last 50 or so years. Millions and millions of lives saved, millions of outcomes. If you do a search for work, research that has been done on HeLa cells over the years, there are thousands of papers that have been written using these cells. A lot of people have made a lot of money, and yet her family have said we couldn't even pay our medical bills. And so this is, this is a story of consent and it's a story of power and it's a story of race. And to me, it's a huge story that I wrote about it, but I didn't want to stop. I just wanted to keep going. And I'd love to be able to express how much of an impact her cells had on the world. And yet she never knew, and her family took a long time for them to find out as well.
Just before we wrap things up, there's two stories that kind of surprised me quite a lot. Two characters. The first was Louis XIV. Don't we hear a lot about his health? And Phineas Gage was another story.
Phineas Gage? I'd forgotten he was in there. And yet, this is probably one that started it. Phineas Gage was a railroad worker in the mid-19th century in America who was at work one day and he was a foreman on the railroad. His tamping iron, which is a great big long iron rod, hit a spark in the ground and was fired basically up through his face and up through the top of his head. And it landed a long way away, covered in the stuff that it went through his head and took with him, all the grease and the brain matter. Again, incredibly, he survived. This went up through the front of his brain, up through the frontal lobe, and surgeons were able to look after the hole that it made in his head. But it was noticed that Phineas Gage, after a time, his personality changed and he became horrible to be around. And it was from that moment that we started to understand that different parts of the brain had different functions, if you like, and that the frontal lobe was one that was involved in inhibition or disinhibition, that now he was being really, really horrid to people, whereas before his brain was able to control that. Now that bit of his brain was damaged. And so it was then realised that phrenology maybe wasn't the way to go, you know, the looking at the lumps and bumps on top of the head, but thinking about parts of the brain and what those little different parts of the brain did. Phineas Gage was really a good first example of us looking at that. It's a fantastic story. And I mean, talking about the gruesome, well, Louis XIV, you say that we don't know much about his health, but so much was written about his health because he was just studied. The people around him would mention all his ailments, and he was a bit of a hypochondriac, I think. But he did have a problem with his rear end. He, like Queen Victoria, he developed an abscess, but this one was down at his rear end and he prodded it and poked it and it wouldn't get any better. And the physicians tried to heal it with red hot irons and herbs and poultices, and still nothing worked. So they called a surgeon because it reached a stage where it became a fistula, which is a connection, if you like, between the outside world and into inside. So he basically developed a new hole down there. And the surgeon was called, and a surgeon called Felix came along and had a look between the king's legs and couldn't do anything right away because he hadn't really done this operation before. So he went away and he practiced on the people of Paris. He found them in prisons and hospitals, and he developed an operation. He developed tools. And he came back and he spent 3 or 4 hours between the king's legs, de-roofing this fistula, getting all the muck out. And he survived. Incredibly, he survived. And it went on to become this thing at court that if you wanted to really be like the king, then perhaps ask the surgeon for your own fistula operation, whether you had one or not.
That was Dr. Susie Edge. Susie's most recent book, Vital Organs, A History of the World's Most Famous Body Parts, is on sale now. Published by Wildfire.
Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Daniel Kramer.